We usually weed off at the dump truck. So we'll just leave the title as is, and I will go through the details, okay? So this is a hypothetical case study that I'm going to tell you about. So I have five genes in the yeast cell cycle. A cell cycle is one gene tells another gene to start doing something, which tells another gene to start doing something, finally makes a cell divide. It goes over again. Okay, so I have five genes. I call them G0 to G4. And here's what's each peak sharply at a particular time in the cell cycle. It's time for that gene to come on and tell some other genes maybe what to do next. So it's a big sharp peak. No two peak at the exact same time. The cumulative production measures peak. So if I don't have time order, I can just wait till the whole thing's over, a whole cell cycle, or 10 cell cycles, whatever, let's pick one, and just measure how much of that protein has been made. And so you can imagine I have five color. What I do is I take the protein, add a colored group, you know, green, blue, you know, things that fluoresce, green, blue, so forth. And at the end, I just measure how much green, blue, and so forth there is in the soup. And I know the cumulative production of each gene. It's a number having to do with the amount of fluorescence, okay? And individual cells are measured in the cell cycle. We consider cell-to-cell variations. I actually get the amount of each one that's been made in each cell. So we're taking the cell as a unit. So you can think each cell is like a person. Think of just the way in a study we have people, we have cells. We don't aggregate over cells in any way. Okay? And the data is cumulative production of each gene in the cycle, but I get no data at all on time order. So I know they come as different. I have no idea which came first, which came second. So I can only break the system at the end and measure cumulative production. And I, because they're yeast, it's easy to get a lot of observations, so I get 10 to the 12th cells, because that's a very good cell counter. And of course, the reason I chose 10 to the 12th is the actual goal is to eliminate here statistical considerations by making the sample size near infinite in order to stress the philosophy, and also because you'll see later, so computability and multiple testing, everything else is not considered. It's as if there was no difference between the lasso of people. I gave this talk last week at Stanford, so there are a lot of statistics, so a lot of mention of the words they like, so they could maybe relate to it. And when I gave it at Stanford, this was an hour talk. Here it's a half an hour talk. And so I'm dealing with that because I know you all know causality. I'm just going to talk twice as fast. Now there are many others. Those are five genes I was able to put fluorescent markers on. There are many other cell cycle genes not measured. Many of them could be common causes of these things. We have the usual confounding. Just because two things are associated doesn't mean they're one cause leading to the other. So I want to know which genes have a direct causal effect on gene I for I equal 1 to 5 in the cycle, not mediated through other genes. So the picture is what I'd like at the end, roughly speaking, is something like this, where the zeroth gene directly causes the fourth, but no other. The first causes the second causes the third, and something like that would be what I want. I want the time order plus who causes what. And of course, I've cross-sectional data with no time order at all. Okay, so that's my problem. So there's no temporal ordering. So no idea how to determine ordering causality by any regression method. See what I mean? Suppose I hope to tell maybe G3 not directly cause G4 and vice versa. Well, suppose I regress G4 on G3 and all the other genes. If I regress G3 on four genes, see if the coefficient, or just the other way, G4 is zero or vice versa. If the coefficient was zero, some might believe that G3 does not cause G4 or vice versa. one way I could do it and hope if that coefficient is zero, I say, well, probably given the other genes, one doesn't cause the other. But it could be, but I might believe instead that even if the coefficient isn't zero, because I'm conditioning on the other genes, which could be common effects of them, as you all know, that could induce a correlation. So maybe I should look at G3 and G4 marginally and see if they're marginally independent. But of course, you can see if they're if they don't cause each other. And, you know, if it goes the other way, if one of the other measured genes is their common cause, that's not a very good way to find out that they don't cause each other. And it gets to be, you know, but at best, I try to look for some independence, and then you can see if I found that I might be able to say something, I might not, you might argue with me, and so forth. But it'd be hard to know how I would time order them if I found no independence at all. Just everything was correlated with everything else, no matter what I conditioned on it. and of course, that's what I do find. There are no independencies, marginal or conditioned, not even close. I mean, and I have no idea of time order. So it seems pretty hopeless. This is this point where I ask the audience, what you've all heard about this, what do you do? Well, obviously, what do you do next? Well, you say you got to get better data because you don't have time order, do knockouts and so forth, and actually intervene and see what happens. Okay, as you know, intervention is not possible for statisticians except if you're Wing Wong. So we aren't Wing Wong, and we want the Nobel Prize. Why let it go to these biologists? So our idea is we've got to torture the data so we know the answer, no matter what. So I'm now going to describe the method. It's been around for about 5 years. Me and Thomas came up with this, and I gave a talk, which I know at least Mark was there 5 years ago in WeAR, which is the same talk, to see how much we've progressed. And it required to even argue with infinite data, which is essentially what I'm telling you 5 years ago, that required a theorem that Thomas and I at the time couldn't prove. But now we're close to a proof with collaboration of Ilya Spitzer and Stefan Lorentzen. So we brought it out of mothball. We're still far from an algorithm finite data set. So comparison with real, any other search algorithms is a real now because we don't have an algorithm. But something. But the philosophy is interesting. So you give up, or most people give up. So what am I going to do? Well, I take the genes and I consider for the moment all possible orderings, that is permutations. Choose, so there are 120. So let's call it the kth permutation. So over bars mean history, 4, 3, 2, 1. And so let's say I have the kth permutation. So I have GK4 as the fourth gene in the kth permutation. So I can do this for kth. 120, I write down the likelihood and then factorize it, the fourth given the earlier third, third given all the earlier, and so forth. And of all those factors, I choose one of them. Here I'm choosing the first gene given the zero, which should go there, and I get rid of it. I replace it by an user-specified density, F star of GK1, that is absolutely continuous with respect to this guy for all GK0. And that's a new distribution, okay? It's not what generated my data, because I replaced that. And we call this new distribution a star distribution. We say we're now in a star world. So there are actually 120 times I could have picked 1, 2, 3, 4. It doesn't do any good to do a marginal, so basically 4. So I have 4 times 120 star worlds in this example. And let's just fix one of them. We're on. Okay. And so in that star world, you can see, the star world just means under this distribution, that the first gene is independent of the zeroth gene by construction. Okay. And why am I doing this? Intuitively, this is just totally true. It's not me. I'm trying to create a world where GK1 was totally randomly assigned. wasn't, so I just... Okay, and so I test for independences in the star world, other than the constructed independence. I know I'm going to find one. So I'm just going to do the same game in the star world. Well, how do you test for independence in the star world? Well, the first thing you have to do is you have to estimate the density you got rid of. Okay, so I estimate it, say, by fitting, you know, a normal regression model, and there's a normal fitted by the parameters by maximum likelihood. If I want that, that's the normal density evaluated, you know. So it's just a density, okay? Of course, I'd like to be as non-parametric as possible, but that's not the point of this talk, so all my models are correctly specified, so. Okay, just for the purposes of this talk, in reality, you'd have to smooth. Okay, and now how do I test for independencies in the star world? Well, suppose I wanted to test whether variable 4 was independent of variable 2, was independent of variable 0 in the star world. Well, what do you usually do? You'd specify something like a normal model for the regression of G4 on G0 and G2, and if I wanted independence, I test whether W1 is 0, right? That's independent. Everybody with me? Of course, I don't have data, so I do OLS if I had data from the star world. I don't, okay? But that's not a problem because I know I take the usual score for that normal model, and, you know, it's going to be the, okay? And to take an expectation in the star world, all I have to do is take the expectation in this world multiplied by the likelihood ratio. That's called the likelihood ratio, the important sampling ratio, the radon-nicotine derivative, or if people do MSM, it's called standardized weights, okay? And so all I do in practice is I regress the fourth variable on these guys, and I use weights, my artificial density I made up, over my estimate, okay? And I test, so I just do weighted least squares, all right? That's how I test for independence of our world, and so I do that. Unfortunately, things don't go so well. I have no independence in this star world or any of the other 480. So, what would you do? You'd give up. You would have given up before. Not me. Nobel Prize. So, I go to a star-star world. What is a star-star world? Well, I marginalize over some of the variables in this set. Let's say I marginalize over GK0. So now I look at the star, I have one of my star distributions of those. I choose one of the 24 potential orderings of them, do the same game, but I go play the same game on the star world, but make a star-star world. So let's say here, I decide I'm gonna drop the index of permutations from now on, it's getting too complicated, but I'm in some star world, which has some ordering. And I replace F star G3 given G2 G1 in my factorization in the star world by some user selected F star star G3. I could do any of them. This is just one star star world for a given star world. So I've constructed a star star distribution that has G3 star star independent of G2 G1. That's not interesting. I did that by construction, right? Okay. So my star-star density is, I just take the star densities, but this one I replace by a star-star, then star and star. That's my star-star world. Okay, and I test for independence in my star-star world. Okay? And without going through it again, all that means, if I want to see whether G4 and G2 are star-star independent given G1, I specify a model there, and, you know, same thing like this. And then I do weighted least squares with these double weights, because that puts me, I'm doing PN in this world under F. I'm interested in solving the score equation star star, so this puts me in the star, F puts me in the star star, so no problem. And after doing all this, I find that in one particular star star world, coming from one particular star world, I find GK1s star star independent GK4, and I get no other independencies. That's just what I found. No, okay, and remember, I'm just I hadn't found anything in Star Worlds, why give up? Please try Star Worlds. Okay, so what can we conclude from our result? What is our result? There's no independencies in this world. There's one independency, no independencies in any star world, or in any, one independency in a particular star world with particular ordering of genes, okay? What can I conclude from those simple things? Well, it turns out I conclude the temporal order is, this is the name of the genes, and that's the ordering of the genes, and that in the star world, yeah, so GK0 is the star, is the gene I marginalized over from the star world first, and then GK1 through GK4 are the orderings of the other four genes in the star world, okay? And so I can, and remember I found GK1 star independent of GK4. That was the only independence I found. I simply conclude that that's the temporal order. I made it, okay? Cross-sectional data, no independency. I conclude GK0 causes GK1, but it doesn't directly cause GK2, GK3, or GK4. I conclude GK1 causes GK2 and GK3, but not GK4. I conclude GK2 causes GK3, but not GK4, and that GK3 causes GK4. Oh, but I keep that for that. Let's go on. I conclude there are one or more unmeasured genes that directly cause both a common cause of GK0 and GK2. There's one or more unmeasured genes, maybe the same one, that directly causes GK0 and GK3, GK0 and GK4, GK2 and GK4. There are no other common causes of the measured genes. So, I get all that by now. Not too shabby. Okay, what does that mean? That is, what I'm really doing is I'm concluding that the causal DAG is the following. So, from my analysis, this is the causal, what? Oh, one more, sorry, you're right. Here's the causal DAG. So I actually get the whole causal DAG. See, 0 causes X1, nothing else, X1 causes X2, X1 causes, the blues are caused, and then I have these unmeasured variables, you see what the common causes are. I conclude that this is exactly the causal DAG generating the data. Okay. Going back. You might wonder, what were the assumptions under which I did that, and how did I do that? You might be wondering that. I won't do that. So I'm going to tell you what the assumptions are. So the first assumption is the observed distribution of G0 to G4 was generated from an underlying directed acyclic graph, which we call the causal graph, in which there were some variables, U-marg, that have been marginalized over, and other variables, unmeasured, U-conditional, that have been conditioned on a certain value. They're called the hidden variables, and we do not know how many there are or what they are, but somewhere there was an underlying causal DAG. U-marg are the possible unmeasured common causes of the measured genes, and thus confounders. U condition can be common effects of the measured genes that we conditioned on, but we didn't know about it. So there's some structure like that, in the world, in the universe, to generate this data. And on that DAG, you know, it's the usual thing, arrows between A and B means on the DAG that A directly causes B relative to the other variables on the graph. That's it. And of course, by causal DAG, we assume it's that any variable V is independent, any variable in the set of variables UG, the measured and unmeasured, is independent of variables it does not cause given its direct causes, which for causal DAG means that you get the usual factorization. So V is all the variables, all those U's, and you get the usual factorization, you know, the product of each variable given its parents, where PAM are the values of the parents of VM dictated by V. It's just the usual DAG factorization. The different cells are statistically independent, And the last one is generalized facialness, which is the key. Any non-trivial independencies in this world or any star world or any star-star world are due to structure. Non-trivial independencies, because we get some in star and star worlds, like in structure. Tell me nothing. Okay? I mean, missing arrows. So any independence I get are due to missing arrows on the causal dad and not to balancing of effects. So for those of you quickly who don't know what faithfulness is, here's the 1 second discussion. Faithfulness. Let's do the simplest case. I just have two variables, x and y, and I find they're independent. Okay? That's all I've measured. But I have this underlying dad. Forget the conditioning part. That just adds, let's say that we didn't condition on anything, because that just adds another layer of complication. So the possible dads for two variables are this one, neither causes either, and there's no unmeasured confounding. X causes Y, no unmeasured confounding. Y causes X, no unmeasured confounding. Neither causes the other, but there's an unmeasured confounder. I was calling that U before, here I'm calling it H. Cause in this direction, plus unmeasured confounding, cause in that direction, plus unmeasured confounding. Now in the data, suppose I see X and Y are independent. Faithfulness allows me to conclude that this is the causal dad that generated the data. A, that neither causes each other, and I have no unmeasured common causes. Because for X to be independent of Y, for example, in this graph, I need the strength of unmeasured confounding to exactly balance the causal effect. So we need this perfect balance of coefficients, and we assume we're not getting perfect balance. Okay? So that's the simplest case. By an extension of that idea, I'm going to assume anything like this. If I see independence, I assume it's due to structure, missing arrows, so I assume X does not cause Y. This very complicated example, star and star-star worlds, that turns out to be enough to conclude the graph I showed you was the unique, roughly, causal dad generating the data. And I'll explain in a minute. Let's see. Why. Okay, so basically, you remember this? Here's the basic idea. Here was the original graph. That, right? First, I divided by the law of x1 given x0. Okay? That effectively gives me a distribution that looks like this. Okay, I remember I was doing it in a slightly better pedagogic style. Hold on, let's not do that yet. Okay. So, under the assumptions, we can prove that the underlying causal data generating data was the one I showed you before. Okay? What does it mean to prove that? So let's just talk about what the math was that we had to wait 5 years to get to. Well, as a mathematical object, the DAG I finally showed you, remember the one I showed you, is nothing but a statistical model defined by a set of distributions factoring, remember, the variables on the DAG. And now, because Thomas makes the pictures and I make the slides, the G's have turned into X's. But the U's are the same. So the X4 is what I was calling G for. So the joint distribution of X4 and U4, because it's a DAG, is you just do each variable given its past, given its parents. And if you just, because we don't have enough time, if I showed you that DAG again, for each variable, I've just put the parents on the right. Okay? That's what it means to have that being the causal DAG. We only see the marginal, which means we sum out the U's. And that causal DAG, remember all the U's were independent and had no parents. Okay? We sum out the U's. Then what? So that's f of x4. F star of x4 was we replaced. We took f of x4 and divided by f of x1 given x0. So we got rid of that term in the joint and put f star x1. And then f star star of x4 was this distribution. We took the f star and replaced f star of x3 by this. We took the likelihood ratio. You know, we took this thing times the joint of x4 and f star. So I know, since I know this set of distributions, I know this set, and I know this set, right? It's just, okay? And so I just prove an easy theorem. I'm going to call this the easy theorem. We didn't have to wait 5 years for this. All densities that factor like this satisfy f star star of x1, x4 is f star star of x1 times f star star of x4. That is, x1 is independent of x4. other than this fact, there are no other F star or star star independencies for the joint of X4 common to all those distributions. Okay? So that's just easy. You can do that using DFEBR8. Okay? Why do I say that? Well, I may run out of time. I can even give you, show you intuitively why you can see that. That's easy. Here's the hard one. There's no other dad. So now I write it X4, because that was the G4, the observables. I write U bar M, because M, because it could be any U's, M can be of any dimension. Hat, there's no other dad with these properties. That's why I was able to conclude this was a unique dad. Now, when I say there's no other dag, it's no other dag has something called a semi-Markov projection, which is an interesting part because you can have weird relationships between the U's other than what you see. So you can show that any of these dags for this kind of thing can be reduced to a dag where you get the same independencies among the observed guys. It can be reduced to a dag where all the U's are independent and have only two children, because I don't really care if there's another dag where the more complicated U structure, as long as it gives the same marginal of what I can see and have the same causal relationships of what I can see. So there's no other dad that has any of these causal relationships I mentioned before. So just think of it, there's no other dad, but it's slightly more technical than that. So, okay, that's a very hard theorem to prove. Okay, now, yeah.
The first thing is easy because you're just cutting edges, right?
Yes. Yeah, I was going to show that, but I don't think I have time. So maybe but you can show it. Thomas will show that in his talk, because I don't really... The first part's easy, and you do it by cutting edges in the graph, and I don't think I have time if I do, because I want to talk about sociology first, and Thomas will, as the thinker, will actually show you how to do things. This is where I start pontificating. Okay, here's the history. Here's my view of statistics, sociology. So what's the sociological implications of what I've just shown, other than the kind of mind blowing? Okay, so historically, most statisticians are negative about causal inference from observational studies. The way I was doing causal inference from that observational studies, I would say if nature randomized, i.e. we have no unmeasured confounders, then the causal effect can be estimated as follows. And when I started doing this, ordinary statistics didn't know how to solve that problem for if you had more than two time points and intermediate variables and causal pathways. but the statisticians, especially mathematical ones, my favorite one since he's not here, is Peter Bickel, say, oh, this stuff's not interested because, you know, we statisticians do association. You'd need real randomization for that. Discovery is what we're doing here is much crazier. It's going from association to causation without background in the subject. We didn't say there were no unmeasured confounders. We discovered it from the empirical data. That's what we did, right? I just had to, how many do we discover that? We discovered time orders, what was confounded, what was. I mean, we went vastly beyond anything I could have ever imagined before I met Thomas and his ilk. Okay? This was considered by statisticians beneath consideration. Then a day came when suddenly there were new data sets with P much, much greater than N called genomics. In a world of real scientists called biologists, asked for help from statisticians. And statisticians delivered. There became a literature of sparsity, and linear models grew up based on the Lance Basso Danzig selector, sparse independent screening, which assumed not only that the linear model held, but only a few coefficients were non-zero. And then they could discover structure when they had more variables, which ones were caught. Which ones had non-zero betas. now, if there was, going back to causality, if there's confounding by unmeasured variables, we would not expect that nearly all coefficients are non-zero, because they all mix each other up. So causality had entered the statisticians through the back door, because these guys who never even believed them wanted to start answering the biologist's question. Their model assumes no unmeasured confounding. They were making a much bigger assumption than we're doing in discovery, because we're neutral about it. And we find out if the data under this faithfulness assumption supports. Okay? So what I'm saying is unless nature randomized, we'd expect many non-zero coefficients. So they're assuming a priori. So one of them was clever enough, Peter Bowman and his colleagues, realized they were really doing causal discovery, and they started looking at the causal discovery algorithms of Spearfish, Shines, and Glymore as possible more useful or realistic sparsity methods than the Lasso or SIS. First, he did it unrealistically without hidden variables, that's causal, which is crazy because we know we can have unmeasured common causes. And now he's trying to allow for hidden variables. They were using what was called the FCI algorithm, which was the state of the art before we got into it, because it stopped if you didn't have any independencies or conditional independencies in the empirical data. What a silly place to stop when there's star, you know, it's like staying on Earth. So, how does this relate? So, I happen to be known as the world's foremost opponent, living opponent, to faithfulness, because David Friedman just died, and Larry Watson and I have gotten arguments with these guys about this whole system. Not about the math, they're all great mathematicians, so we wrote joint papers about what the issues were, but it was philosophical, because our joint papers, they agreed that no finite sample size could you make inferentially binding discovery statements, even if you believe faithfulness. First time mentioning inference, even if consistent point-wise, because there are non-faithful distributions that can't be distinguished from faithful distributions with a causal effects bit. And that X, I can have, in that X independent of Y example, I can have X almost independent of Y, still have faithfulness, and have a huge causal effect almost balanced out, but it's a compounding effect is nowhere near zero causal effect. And so when this was realized, Peter Spirita suggested, we'll only talk about near faithfulness. We don't not only allow causal faithfulness, you can't even have near faithfulness violations, so we can do things in finite samples. If you follow the P greater than N literature, that's exactly the move they had to make. I mean, they're not even looking for faithfulness, they're just trying to estimate these betas. They have to make their betas bounded away from zero or going to zero at a certain rate so they get any kind of uniformity result. I mean, they're just recapitulating all this much more fancy math because they're actually, you know, mathematicians. Okay, so now, after criticizing that, what they're doing and what CERCE is doing now, there's something that's changed in the atmosphere. What I mean by this is in the debate mentioned earlier, Wasserman and I were arguing with Thomas and his fellows about could you make reliable causal conclusions from these discovery algorithms for the reasons of near faithfulness and why so forth, because of near cancellation. And think of it as we were discussing in the old days in the context of whether we can discover, for example, that ingrown toenails cause breast cancer when no randomized trial of ingrown toenails and breast cancer has ever been done or is likely to be done. We were imagining you were trying to infer causality, and that was the basis you were going to finally use. And we just said these methods are completely insane. And that was, if you read the debate, that was the tone of it. Times have changed. Now the argument is sparsity assumptions, which are, as I've already said, stronger than what we're making, with uniform detectability, all right, this is what Peter Bickel said, because causal conclusions we get from that are not binding. They're only suggesting. They just tell the biologist, try this randomized experiment. So it's not the final arbiter. It's just an ordering of what experiments to do. And to be honest, I can go with that. Because then it becomes an empirical question. Whose insane algorithm, with whatever insane assumptions they want to make, leads to predictions for the scientists to go run randomized experiments who has the highest hit rate on finding actual important causal things in those randomized experiments. This isn't the final arbiter. And that's what we were arguing about. So this new world where you can suddenly do the randomized experiments has completely undercut what was driving the fight between us. So now I think in this game, like the Joma thing, question is only empirical. What P greater land and procedure, or causal discovery procedure, including the one I showed you, except it's not a procedure yet because we don't have an implementation examples, but to be done, has the best track record for picking informative experiments. And so this is an interesting question, and nobody's going to be regulating on the basis of your discovery algorithm. They're just going to be doing experiments. I want to first, the final thing I'm going to say is, what motivated the current work? Well, Peter Spearies used to argue why discovery based on FCI, that was looking for independence in the data and doing this kind of thing based on faithfulness, was not so terrible. He said for two reasons. It rarely found anything. So in that first example of X and Y, if X was independent of Y, I learned non-causality. If X and Y were dependent, I learned nothing. Unlike the equivalent of the last, which assumes the regression coefficients are causal, okay? If he sees association, he says, well, all sorts of graphs give association. No one measured pure confounding, pure causation. I can't choose between them. You have to have a very unusual situation where these algorithms return anything but don't know. So they rarely found anything is true of the algorithm I just showed you. So Thomas and I spent a week before we came up with this amazing example that's mind-blowing, because there are only certain data-generating mechanisms where this whole approach will find something. Most of them can't draw any conclusions. Peter's second point was, when it did not find much. Because if you find independence in the observed data, you find maybe, something causes something, but not much of the whole structure. It just turns out, if you look at the FCI algorithm. And that was my motivation, because I noticed that, when we go to looking at star and star-star worlds, we still may rarely find anything. But when we do, we can find everything. As you just saw, I found the entire structure from this crazy data. Why is that? It's because the key to getting a conditional independence after dividing by things like this, right, essentially tells us, if you believe faithfulness, that's what tells us that G0 precedes G1 and is its direct cause, and that G2 and G1 precede G3 and its direct cause, roughly. Thomas is going to give you the accurate talk. The thinker was waving his hands. I'm the demagogue, remember. He will correct all false statements. Okay, this is purely logical, incisive presentation. This is just to get you going. Except for a few sharps, which Thomas amazingly invented, which I give him, I would never have invented them. Those are sharps for rare examples where this isn't true. But to many orders of magnitude, what I'm telling you here is true. Because basically, to get a conditional independence, it really means arrows aren't there. After dividing, you had to divide by not only a correct time ordering, but something that had no, when you divided G1 by G0 and got an independent, there better not be a common cause between G1 and G0, another arrow into G1 from a U that's also into some variable like G4 that you're going to finally get the independence with, because you didn't divide by the real causal determinant of G1. You just divide by G0. But to get structure, you would have had to divide by G0 and U. So the very fact that I got an independence later means there couldn't have been as well as a U into that G1 as well from G0. A U into G1 as well as G0, an arrow from G0 into G1, where that U also had an arrow into G4, where I'm going to finally find it show independence, because I would have had confounded. And I couldn't have gotten it by structure. So not only does it tell me time order, it tells me all sorts of things about what must not be confounded.
And that's where the power comes from. So if nature had actually made G1 independent of G0, we couldn't have found anything. It was the very fact that we didn't find independences in this world and found them in the star-star world that gave us this unbelievable power under the assumption that any independence we found were due to structure and not to balancing, or if we ever get to finite samples, ear power. Okay.
So you said there are plenty of examples where you don't find anything. Are there also examples where you find something but it's consistent with a large number of structures?
Yeah, we worked hard to get this mind-blowing example. This is not typical. This is hard work. Thomas, do you want to correct anything?
I just mentioned that that if you were trying to work out how this related to instrumental variables, it doesn't relate to instrumental variables. In the switch of the, well, I mean, it does, but not, you know, not in a simple way. So I mean, you can see the instrumental variable model in there.
I'm sure they all see one in there. That's not even the right picture.
Okay, so the next one. Anyway.
No, that's already after I divide it.
Anyway, so I'm giving a different talk from the abstract that was in there.
He's going to give the story, the real story behind how you approach those easy and hard theorems, especially the hard theorem.
There's some cases where you could have additional information just to get your first one. You know, so would that help?
Any additional one? So
you would know it's got to be that one.
Yes. So for example, here, this graph. Here's a graph where I have someone, I'm just going to give you an example, which is exactly what you said, so let me just say. So I have some data, just three variables. This is only an observed world thing, where everything's correlated except for the fact that A and C are independent given B. That's the only thing, B, okay? I can't conclude any causal relationship from that. But if I have the prior knowledge that A is temporally prior to B, prior to C, that simple fact, A temporally prior to B, prior to C, plus faithfulness, allows me to conclude B causes C. But without that prior knowledge, I couldn't conclude that from just that data. That's an example where prior knowledge can make these things even stronger. It's true in general, though. I'm not sure how much there's a theorem about that. Any comments?
In your example, you stopped when you found one independence.
So now I'll go back. Yeah, so let me show you something.
That's one question, and the other one is, what happens if you find...
Wait, let me answer that one first. It'll probably answer your other one, okay? Let me just... go back to a slide I didn't show you all. And if it doesn't, we'll ask your second one. Suppose I had started with just one of my 580 possible star-star worlds. I found no independencies. I chose one, found no independencies. Then I chose one particular star-star world, the one, and found G1 independent of G4. So I 500 and whatever it was, I can't remember, 79 star worlds I hadn't checked, and exponentially greater than that, star-star worlds I hadn't checked. I just was lucky and found this structure, and the first thing I did, I don't have to check anymore. Because those facts alone turn out to be sufficient to know that whole causal graph, so I can tell you what's going to happen everywhere else. You wouldn't necessarily know which one to start with first, but had that happened, I don't have to look any further. Okay. Oh, so So there is a third. I think you have, so I think here I was actually lying if you go to a third. I think what we have to have, it's no good to go more than, if you have M variables,
yeah.
You don't want to go to more than M minus two star stars, because you can't get more, at some point you can't get more. Is that what it was, M minus two? Just like we have an independence oracle, I have a theorem oracle. Okay.
This clock is still about 5 minutes.